Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
I went down to the shoreline.
You might recognize Lake Superior in their music.
Watch the sunrise.
But is Great Lakes Country really a thing? We'll hear from Brianne Marie and Front Porch Sinners. Plus, with the pandemic almost over, we hope, have we learned the lessons from a century ago?
It's not the same disease. We can't just apply the 1918 to 1920 epidemic on top of this one and say this is what will happen. But my biggest takeaway from this is one of those big moments.
Those stories and the regional news and review after this.
News and issues from a superior point of view.
I went down to the shoreline.
You might recognize Lake Superior in their music.
Watch the sunrise.
But is Great Lakes Country really a thing? We'll hear from Brianne Marie and Front Porch Sinners. But first, with the pandemic almost over, have we learned the lessons from a century ago? Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Last year, at the beginning of the pandemic, we spoke with local historian and author Tony Durkins about the pandemic a century before, of 1919 and 1920. The occasion was the release of his latest book then, Duluth, an Urban Biography. Now that we're approaching what we hope is the end of the pandemic, it's worth another look, especially when there was a time 100 years ago when they also thought the pandemic was ending. Here's our conversation from April 2020 with Tony Durkins. Tony Durkins has written or co-written over 24 books. He's also the publisher at Zenith City Press, so it's not surprising the books he's written are largely about Duluth and the Twin Ports, and particularly the history of the area. Those include Lost Duluth and Crossing the Canal, both finalists for the Minnesota Book Award. His latest, coming out on April 15th, which used to be tax day, is Duluth, an Urban Biography. In that telling, he includes the story of the Twin Ports in the 1918 flu pandemic. Tony joins us by phone from Duluth. Welcome to Simply Superior.
Good morning. Thank you, Robin. Thanks for having me.
You're quite welcome. So when you started writing this book, you probably did not have the pandemic or a pandemic top of mind.
Yeah, I started working on the book about a year and a half ago. And what the book does is cover the entire history of Duluth. And we go back 2.6 billion years to the okay. Precambrian lava flows that formed the bed of Lake Superior right up to the recent mayoral election in November here. So there's not a deep dive into the flu 1918. Of course, 1918, just a pivotal date in Twin Ports history. Not only do we have a bunch of soldiers off to war in Europe, but we had the fires of 1918 that coincided with the flu epidemic when it reached the Twin Ports in the fall of 1918. So, yeah, it's a fascinating topic where we touch on it briefly in the book. So if you want to talk about that flu, it was a strange time here.
Not to jump ahead, we're going to talk about the book you have and about the particular area that concerns us right now, but has this given any thought to maybe writing a book, Twin Ports 1918? It sounds like there's so much going on there.
Yes, there's so much going on. There was a couple of books published last year about the fire, but not about the flu in particular. You could take that whole period between 1918 and 1920, and then you've got Duluth's most tragic moment in June 1920,
right,
with the lynchings, and throughout 1920 and even before that, we had trouble with our corruption in our police department. In fact, a month after the lynching, Duluth's chief of police, John Murphy, and 11 others were arrested for smuggling whiskey across the Canadian border. We also had 15 Duluth cops on leave for drinking and gambling. And we had to fire another 18 that didn't pass the civil service exam. So Duluth, in between 1918 and 1920, probably its most tumultuous period.
Well, again, not to jump ahead, but I was wondering if the lynching was informed in some way by the pandemic, by the fires, by all the turmoil that was going on shortly before.
I couldn't really find a connection to that. 1920 was kind of the last throes of the Spanish flu epidemic that started in 1918, and by the spring of 1920 was kind of the final wave had gone through. Prohibition started as well. So certainly what the communities had gone through, they'd been gone through a lot of turmoil. So you might, you know, well, I can't find a direct connection there. You can certainly think that the Duluth Superior area, like the rest of the country, was kind of on edge.
Mm-hmm. One thing you said, Spanish flu, and of course that's not your term. You're just using the term that was out there.
Exactly. We don't want to call it the Spanish flu. Other than the same thing, we can't call this the Chinese coronavirus. It's just the convenient term at the time.
Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at Snopes has something. It's actually not their article, so it doesn't have their imprimatur on it, but an article they thought was interesting enough to post. And number one of misconceptions is the pandemic originated in Spain, to which it answers, no one believes the so-called Spanish flu originated in Spain.
Right. And from what I understand, it's 1918, and Spain was neutral during World War One. You had these other, you know, countries like England, France, and Germany that were all underreporting the epidemic. So the numbers in Spain, which was doing more accurate reporting, seemed higher, and that's one of the reasons. And it was also, you know, back in that period of our history, you wanted to pin something on another group if you could. Especially if they were in political disagreement with you. Mm-hmm. And so this is all part of that back in 1918. So Spain and the Spanish are vilified for something they had absolutely no fault whatsoever of their own in. It's fascinating how it all works out.
And the numbers have a correlation to what happened here. So tell us about that. How did it manifest itself?
Well, it came to us in by late September 1918. When we started, it was the 10th of October when the Superior decided to go under a ban, and it was the next day in Duluth. And this affected churches, schools, theaters, lodges. We're very popular at the times, your Elks Club, Rotary, and Masons and things. There was a whole bunch of those fraternal groups that met all the time. Those were all forbidden. The restaurants remained open. Both the Twin Ports had already voted themselves dry, so there were no saloons or everything was limited. Funerals were limited to members of the deceased. But yet industry roared on. People still went by the thousands to the shipyards to work and ate in cafeterias together. All right, so we did some of this good, some of it bad. There's also, this is one of the interesting thing about the Duluth ban, they limited the streetcars to 85 passengers, yet Duluth's largest streetcar only had 48 seats in it.
but seriously, we have the vision back then of people hanging off of them and riding
exactly.
on a roof. And frankly, what you can see of pictures of trains today in India, and India is dealing with the exact same sort of thing.
Exactly. It's the same thing. It's just like you have, you know, we have to remember Duluth in 1918, just shy of 100,000 people. In fact, the estimates, we thought we had about 115, but when the count for the 1920 census came in, we had just under 99,000. Same thing, Superior was expected to hit 50,000 by 1920, and it was less than 40. Of course, your city itself and your local boosters club, like your chambers of commerce, like to go with the highest number possible, right? So this was kind of over-reporting by the city, under-reporting. But the flu did stop, 1920 flu, accurate counting in the census. So there's something that reflects on us from today. Hmm. Luckily, we can fill out the census online, mail it in, whereas in 1920 it relied on people knocking door by door.
Mm-hmm. And going back to those streetcars, back then you still had horses, of course, and you had a growing number of cars, but nowhere near today, and that would have been the way to get around.
Exactly. Yeah, right. The wealthy in 1918 had automobiles.
Right.
And the rest rode the streetcars. The horses were phasing out. The streetcars were electrified in 1890, but there were still some, especially teamsters, literally driving teams of horses, carrying heavy wagon loads back and forth. So yeah, you had this combination of ways to get around, and certainly with the majority, I think over 60% of the population identifying as recent immigrants. Mm-hmm. And most of these immigrants came from countries they were poor, unskilled laborers who found works in the various mills and factories along the water. And the streetcars was how they got around, how they got to work.
So how long of a period did that happen? Or
the ban lasted 6 weeks in Superior, 7 in Duluth. And you can look at some of the statistics and say, you know, it worked out pretty good for us. During that peak, 325 people died in Duluth. But our safety commissioner at the time, Bernard Silverstein, looking at the national data, set our per capita death rates set well below the national average. And he, in fact, he said, if we had the same percentage as in some eastern cities, more than 700 would have died in Duluth. Right. Over in Superior, 39 official deaths, over 1,600 flu cases. That's just 1918. Right. So when you look at St. Paul during 1918, their ban only lasted 8 days. Over 1,100 people died. Hmm. Minneapolis limited their ban to 30 days, about 4 to 5 weeks. 944 died. Granted, we have a smaller population base, not that much smaller back then. Right, but only 327 died in Duluth by contrast. So you can see that following those guidelines as best you could.
Mm-hmm. There's also some question over exactly, you know, what the numbers were. So first of all, the world population was something like 1.8 billion, not what we are today at all. And I'm reading one account that says 500 million affected by it or mm-hmm. who got it. So that's, a quarter right there.
And then percent of those died, 50 million died.
You have the 50 million. I've seen some that have as low as half of that or maybe even lower. I don't know what sort of method was used and what sort of count. But
exactly. And we're talking inaccurate count. You know, the Native American population took a significant hit. But because of underreported, we don't know what the percentage was because not all Native Americans filled out the census or mm-hmm. Locally what happened in a lot of times, those who were in mixed families, say in Fond du Lac, would fill out the census and say they're French rather than Native American. And so you get skewed numbers. So we don't have the accuracy of those, you know, numbers that we would hope we'd have today. One of the things I thought was interesting, John Barry, author of a book on the 1918 flu, said this the other day, that the COVID-19, what we're dealing with now, is less deadly than the 1918 flu, which is actually H1N1, but much more contagious. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think these measures we're doing today, just the wise, common sense thing to do, really.
Right. We're speaking with Tony Durkins. He's the publisher at Zenith City Press, whose latest book is Duluth, an Urban Biography. It's due out the middle of this month, and it includes information about the 1918 flu pandemic and how it affected the Twin Ports. So we had public buildings close and a form of sheltering in place. Do I understand there was a fine for violating it?
The Duluth ban. Mm-hmm. Had a fine up to $1,000, which would be over $17,000 in today's dollars. Or you could be sent to the county jail or the county work farm for up to 85 days. I saw one instance of a violation. The gentleman who ran the Empress Theater decided to have a show one day, and the word got out, and he was fined. That's a pretty swift penalty, $17,000, when you think of it.
Right.
Whatever you're doing, you're not going to be able to make $17,000.
No, not then. And then the alternative of going to jail is sort of defeating the purpose, right? Because
right,
now
right.
You're going to a place where
you're
possibly
more likely to catch it. Yeah. Moose Lodge in West Duluth and Camel's Lodge down on Superior Street became flu hospitals, as did the original armory, which was by then the Shrine Auditorium, the 1896 armory that's on First Street, also pressed into service as this, because, of course, our own armory and St. Louis County Courthouse were being used, lost their homes in the 1918 fire. That is actually the fight. The flu ban in Duluth went into effect on October 11th, and on October 12th, the fire started. So you had that little 1-2 punch right there. And it's the same time the war's wrapping up. Yeah, it's a time of chaos. But it's just fascinating to me that the flu and the fire hit almost simultaneously.
The natural question is, was there any connection? But I don't even want to ask the question, because what could there possibly have been as a connection?
Well, yeah, and a lot of what's sad is a lot of these people that were displaced or injured because of the fire ended up dying of the flu.
So a connection in terms of result, not cause.
Right. A lot of these people, they set up makeshift camps out of tents, mm-hmm. where people were living in what they called the burn zone. Between Cloquet and Duluth and the surrounding areas that had been burned out by the fire.
Anything on the Superior side?
As far as with the fire?
Yeah.
Not so much.
Or no. Camps or just people migrating over?
The 1918 flu seemed to hit Duluth much harder than Superior. And conversely, when we get to the January and February of 1920, that last wave of the flu through the U.S., Superior much harder than Duluth. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, Bernard Silverstein, the safety commissioner, talked of you know, maybe stopping traffic between Duluth and Superior at one time.
Really? We have rumors of that today.
Exactly. So this is the thing about history, you know, doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it paraphrases itself quite often.
Right.
You know, it goes around, comes around. There's a lot of lessons in our history. They might not correlate exactly from the past to how they do today.
But some things are going to be the same because the situations are the same and the relationships, right? So the Duluth-Superior relationship in terms of traveling between the towns, obviously the same bridges weren't there, but you still had to get there. I want to bring this up right now to clarify something because I don't want to mislead people, but on last week's show we mentioned that there was a rumor that cars were being stopped on a bridge, and Mayor Jim Payne of Superior said, no, that's not happening. You can go over. It's fine. However, no sooner did he say that than Rhode Island actually did start stopping cars with New York license plates. And even though the states aren't contiguous, by the way, they got Connecticut in between them. So, yes, it seems like you're pointing out there is a basis in history of these things happening. It's not our imagination that they could happen. And something that may seem unthinkable one day, a couple days later, is general practice.
Absolutely. And when we look back at 1918, there's one bridge, the interstate bridge from Rice's Point to Connor's Point, that brings streetcars and automobiles and pedestrians back and forth between there. The jobs are flowing both ways. A lot of people in Superior working in Duluth, not as many in Duluth working in Superior. So we've got these two communities going back and forth. And at the time, remember, we're only 10 years out from being the busiest port in the world, surpassing New York, right? I think by 1920, we're back down to second place, but still, we're the largest inland port in the world. In fact, the first few cases in 1918, the majority of the cases they were seeing were sailors on ore carriers, and then passengers from passenger trains from elsewhere bringing it in, right? And that was reported in early November of 1918. So this is when we're not quite a month into the ban at this time, the stay-at-home orders, and you know, this is how it's tracking. But you know, they pretty much stopped looking at that after a week or so, mm-hmm. because it's here now. You know, what they were doing back then is basically, if you close that bridge, you close commerce between two communities that relied on each other for jobs and their economy.
So again, an echo to today. At the end of the day, economics and the economy is a human construct, right? We can invent money, we can invent a Federal Reserve, or we can get rid of it, we can have a gold standard, silver, whatever. But those are all things that human beings can decide.
We seem to be worried about, you know, how will the economy survive, how will these man-made constructs survive? And I think we should just more worry about
how we're going to survive.
Right. We'll work that all out later.
Right.
Right. That's the way I've seen it. And I've seen this in when I study history before. there will be lows, there will be highs.
Right. We're talking to Tony Durkins, a publisher at Zenith City Press, whose latest book, Duluth, an Urban Biography, is due out in the middle of the month, and it includes information about the 1918 flu pandemic and how it affected the Twin Ports. What's your biggest takeaway from the history and maybe how it relates to what we're experiencing right now?
Well, I think the lesson we can take is, when you look at how Duluth and Superior handled it back then with these bans that stayed in place for 6-7 weeks, as opposed to other communities that eased up right away because of economic pressures, like in St. Paul in particular, was because of economic pressures. The people, the communities that followed those guidelines to distance themselves, to not go to the theater or to church and everything, they did much better. It's not the same disease. We can't just apply the 1918 to 1920 epidemic on top of this one and say this is what will happen. But my biggest takeaway from this is one of those big moments. Our community, the Twin Ports, have been through many of these big moments. And we've come out of it. We've come out strong on these things. And from studying Duluth Superior history, one of the things I've noted is that both communities always do better when they're working together, hand in glove. It was the Twin Ports. We went together to come up with that name in 1910, to pick that name, because we wanted something that showed how unified we were. And I think I see that a little today in Mayor Payne and Larson coming together over the refinery issue. And I think if Duluth and Superior, you know, the big takeaway for me is we've been through things that are similar, and we'll get through this as well.
Great. Well, on that optimistic note, Tony Durkins is the publisher at Zenith City Press, whose latest book, Duluth, an Urban Biography, is due out in the middle of this month. It includes information about the 1918 flu pandemic and how it affected Twin Ports. And how can we get a copy of the book? Because bookstores are closed at the moment.
Please visit us at Zenith City Press online at zenithcity.com, and I can send you, you can pre-order a signed author copy.
We wouldn't want to miss that. Thank you for joining us, Tony Durkins.
Well, thanks for having me this morning, Robin, and thanks to your audience at Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're quite welcome.
Coming up, Great Lakes Country with Brianne Marie and the Front Porch Sinners.
Heart is racing and starting to sweat. Wrapped up together, I'm out of
The fiddle in this catchy rockabilly song is so bluegrass you can almost see the chickens scurrying around. But it's not about hog farms or bales of hay on pickup trucks. Rather, it's about the central hillside of Duluth.
On a warm summer day, in central hillside.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. The music genre we're sharing today is Great Lakes Country, and it originates from a front porch in Duluth. That's where you'll find Brianne Marie and the Front Porch Sinners, who include a couple of Wisconsinites helping out. Brianne Tepler was well known in Duluth business and higher education circles when she broke out in a singing career in 2013, a calling in response to personal tragedy. She translated that to song, and it's okay to call it therapy, and got a group to back her. In February, they released what is for Brianne her third album, and there's an asterisk on that that I let her explain when she joined me on the show. Here's our conversation from back then. Welcome to Simply Superior, Brianne.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And you want to explain that asterisk?
Absolutely. So this project is our first full band produced album. In the prior works that I've done, they've been under Brianne Marie. But with the efforts of everyone in the band on this particular project, there's no way I could just put my name on it. It was a full band effort.
All right. Well, and I'm going to ask you more about the band and the band's name in a bit. But first, let's go back in history a little bit. We've known each other for quite a while. You once upon a time were Brianne Defoe at the Duluth Area Chamber of Commerce. I think membership director, whatever it was, you knew everybody in town, right?
Well, you know, David Ross always said working at the Chamber in Duluth was one of the biggest stages in Minnesota. And yeah, I was a director for Fuse Duluth and membership. And shortly after my time there, I got divorced, I remarried, and went into higher education. And I've been at the College of St. Scholastica since.
Right. And then the other personal tragedies that I alluded to, you lost your brother in a car accident, your father took his own life, and you had other, frankly, more than anybody should, tragic experiences of people close to you. So would we even recognize the Brianne that we knew back then?
You would not. I've been through so many situations and life experiences that have really evolved who I am as a person. You mentioned that it's okay to say that my music is therapy, because it is. In 2018, my other brother, Justin, died in an ATV accident. So now I've suffered 3 immediate family member losses since 2006. And just digging deeper each time into the music and songwriting and really not taking life for granted. These types of losses shape how a person does all aspects of their lives, how they are as a parent or a wife or an employee or a musician. All of it is impacted.
Mm-hmm. And you're not the first person, of course, to unveil yourself in music. Joni Mitchell is very famous for it. Have you ever felt that you've been too revealing?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think that with social media, we are, as a society, we are more apt to share than we ever have before. But each time that I share something about losses or mental health, there's a moment where I have to make that decision. Is this too much? Does this need to be shared? And I go by that process of, is it helpful? Is it kind? Is it truthful? And I got to tell you, most often when I share something, I get a response via private message from someone that says, thank you for sharing that. That really helped me today. Or thank you for sharing your story. Can you help me find resources for me and my daughter? So I think that sharing, there's a balance there that you have to be careful with. But I always have an answer to why. But why am I sharing this?
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you said that. I'm actually trying to cut back on social media. I don't think everybody needs to know what I had for breakfast or my opinion on your breakfast. But that said, there are, just today, a friend of mine said, I am all clear. There's no cancer, you know, and it's heartwarming. As you said, the way you express something may help bring some solace to somebody. We're speaking with Brianne Tepler of Brianne Marie and the Front Page Center. Front Page. I'm still in the newspaper, right? And the Front Porch Centers. Along the lines of personal, let's hear Too Tired to Cry off your new album, Juniper. Set that up for us.
Yeah, Too Tired to Cry is a song about grief. I found a connection between in northern Minnesota and Wisconsin here where the weather is too cold to snow, and that connection we have between when we're just too exhausted to muster up some tears to cry.
That is a wonderful analogy, especially since we just went through the sub-zero temperatures, and thankfully it was too cold to snow. Here is Too Tired to Cry by Brianne Marie and the Front Porch Sinners.
Chasing ghosts again this week, looking for you in my sleep. Went to all the places we would go, like that pawn shop downtown, the one with all the old guitars, and the park on Masaba Avenue. So weak, standing here unable to speak. If you had given us a little more time, one more trip around.
And that was Too Tired to Cry off the new album Juniper by Brianne Marie and the Front Porch Sinners. And that was Mesaba Avenue you were singing about. Tell us about the band's name and the people in it. And as I alluded to earlier, a few are from the Wisconsin side. Am I correct?
You are correct. The band name Front Porch Sinners comes from me thinking about my preteen and teenage days on a front porch in Central Hillside, where we may have been, I don't know, saying some swear words and some things that other folks might say we were sinning or having some sin. And, you know, it's also one of those country style names. So you've got Johnny Cash and the Tennessee Two, or, you know, these classic Opry, Grand Ole Opry days of artists where you have the lead and the something. Well, for me, that's Front Porch Sinners. And I'll tell you who they are. We've got Evan Tepler on guitar, and we've got Matt Groom on drums, Kaylin Spencer on fiddle, Johnny Blaze Peterson on pedal steel, Kyle Gondick Anderson on bass, and Danielle Gondick Anderson on harmony vocals. We're just a fun group. We have classic country instruments, but set to the types of things that people in these Great Lakes Rust Belt communities go through, these hard times that we go through.
So did you coin the phrase Great Lakes Country, or did you pick that up somewhere? Is there a whole section at Electric Fetus I don't know about?
I coined that term. I hope it catches on. I'd love to find a whole Great Lakes Country community out there. So if you're listening right now and you feel like you play Great Lakes Country, please reach out to me on our social media and let's get a group going so we can pass along these ideas and these sounds. I think it is a unique sound that we have, but it pulls on traditional classic country with our fiddle, our pedal steel, the upright bass. When you put those sounds together, you're having a very much classical feel to it. But it certainly, the stuff that we're singing about really speaks to today and what these generations are going through in these Rust Belt communities.
Mm-hmm. And you alluded to social media, so tell us how we find you in URL, webpage.
Our webpage is briannemarie.com. That's briannemarie.com. And all of our social media is linked to that website.
All right. And tell us about the title track of your new album, Juniper.
The title of the album and the title track have two different juniper meanings. So the juniper title of the album stands for a juniper tree, which is a very rugged tree with deep roots that can withstand a lot of harsh elements. The place that I first found a juniper tree was in the Colorado Rockies outside of Denver, Colorado, when I was at Red Rocks Amphitheater. And that's what the album is named after, and the pacing of the album feels like a long hike in the Rocky Mountains. Now, the juniper title track, or the song, that was written in quarantine. So it was actually written after the whole album was done being written. It was an added song. And I wrote it about a young woman named Juniper, someone that I imagine who is going through trying to navigate love and relationships. So it's a song about lust and love, which is a subject that I don't often write about, but it just, it turned out fantastic with all of the instrumentation that the band put into it, and just has a very unique vibe or mood, as the kids say these days.
All right. Well, let's hear that mood. Here's Juniper by Brianne Marie and the Front Porch Sinners.
Thank you.
That was Juniper by Brianne Marie and the Front Porch Sinners. I am speaking with Brianne Marie Tepler, and Juniper is also the title of their new album. With all the adversity you've experienced, I'm almost scared to ask you this, but tell me about Dead Man Walking, another song on the album. Unless you just borrowed the name from the movie, there's got to be a story behind it.
Dead Man Walking is our one song on the album that I did not write. This song was written by Kirk Jenness. Kirk is the lead singer and songwriter for the Iron Range Outlaw Brigade, which is a bunch of rowdy boys from up north in the Iron Range of Minnesota. And we share a pedal steel player with the Iron Range Outlaw Brigade and ourselves. So Johnny Blaze is in both bands. And we are probably the biggest fans of IROB. That's Iron Range Outlaw Brigade for short. And we knew that we would want to cover IROB songs. And this, we've been doing this for a few years. But when we first played Dead Man Walkin', there was so much swagger in that song that every bandmate, every Front Porch Sinner played to the personality of this dead man walking around. And so we have a ton of fun with that song. I think it really comes through on the track. And for fun, we added two trumpets instead of one to give it that spaghetti western feel. And this is the first song I've ever recorded my trumpet on. And then my friend Matt Livefree joined me with his trumpet parts. So it's a fun tune.
All right, well, we're going to let it swagger us out of here. We've been speaking with Brianne Marie Tepler of Brianne Marie and Front Porch Sinners. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Robin.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hi, Robin.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, Danny, the wolf hunt is still an issue, and there's new information about the last one?
Yeah, there was a study that was released this week that a third of Wisconsin's gray wolf population has been killed by hunters and poachers as a result of the Trump administration's decision to end federal protections for most gray wolves across the country. Those findings are according to a new study by UW-Madison researchers, and they found that around 100 wolves were killed in addition to the 218 wolves that were harvested during the February wolf hunt. If you remember, you know, state licensed hunters just blew past their quota and harvested nearly double what they were allowed and exceeded the state's quota. And basically, the study's researchers are saying that it would be unwise to hold another wolf hunt this fall because the past hunt in February, there was a very high probability that a large number of wolf packs will not reproduce this year. But some of the research behind this study is coming under question from other wolf biologists and researchers who are questioning the assumptions that are used as part of modeling to develop this study. It relied on modeling that used radio collared wolves to estimate the number of illegal killings. Basically, it assumes that most of those lost collars were due to illegal killings, but Other wolf biologists are disputing that, while the researchers who have released the study have invited others to share evidence to the contrary. So there's still debate among the scientific community over what the population is going to be like heading into this fall.
All right. Well, Brooks, on the Minnesota side, there's also a wolf hunt development.
Yeah, the development being there probably won't be one until next year at the earliest. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources said this week it won't even consider holding a wolf hunting or trapping season until next year, in that it's working to update its 20-year-old wolf management plan. That plan probably won't be done by March. So until they get that plan done, there just won't be any guidelines or any season launched. Minnesota last held wolf seasons between 2012 and 2014 until courts blocked them. In the past 20 years, Minnesota's wolf population has been somewhat stable. In 1999, we had about 2,400 wolves. In 2019, the most recent year available, we had about 2,700. And that number has gone up and down slightly over the years.
All right. Well, also related to the outdoors, there was a notable passing in the area this week.
Yes, the so-called father of the Superior Hiking Trail, Tom Peterson, died recently at age 76. Peterson was literally the trailblazer for the first 200 miles of the Superior Hiking Trail on Minnesota's North Shore. He went out in the woods, bushwhacked his way, crossed rivers, and marked the route. He just had a compass, USGS maps, and the backing of the DNR and the newly formed Superior Hiking Trail Association back in 1986. I talked to a number of people who remembered him fondly. He was also a UMD philosophy instructor. He worked on several other trails on the North Shore as well. And his impact on the shore, on recreation up there, cannot be understated. If you're walking on a trail anywhere north of Duluth along Lake Superior, you're probably seeing the world through Tom Peterson's eyes.
Danny, back to Superior. The police department has some new training protocol, and I took one of those in Duluth years ago where the lesson was shoot or don't shoot, but now I understand it's more about conflict resolution and de-escalation.
Yeah, so the Superior Police Department is among law enforcement agencies in Wisconsin that's using virtual reality training to try to hone officers' skills to help de-escalate crisis situations. And this is coming, as police training has really come under scrutiny surrounding the use of force in the wake of the police killing of George Floyd. In Superior, police have recently just started using this virtual reality training simulator that's been offered by Dallas-based Business Survivor. And so officers are using VR headsets that display 3D scans and screenshots of real-world objects, and it's all part of training scenarios where they'll run through situations ranging from responding to a person who is experiencing a mental health crisis or even a mass shooting. And Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander says that this system will expand on their current training on de-escalation and implicit bias for officers. Basically, he's saying that they try to gear all of their training scenarios so that if officers use effective communication and de-escalation, that they can resolve these situations without the use of force, and that they try to see those positive outcomes whenever possible. And, law enforcement training is really under scrutiny, since the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. A lot of expert testimony during that trial kind of centered on the training methods used at the Minneapolis Police Department. And, we've seen across the country, states and police departments revising use of force policies. In Wisconsin, we've seen Governor Tony Evers recently sign bills into law where police chokeholds would be barred with limited exceptions, except for like a life and death circumstance. Police would be required to report incidents when force is used and also publish those use of force policies on their websites. So there's been a lot of changes surrounding this. And for the Superior Police Department, they hope that this virtual reality training will be another tool that they can use to, help reduce those situations where force is used.
And finally, if you're looking forward to the return of the Dragon Boats Festival, like we had with Grandma's recently, how long do you have to wait?
Well, you'll have to wait until at least next year. They recently announced that the Lake Superior Dragon Boat Festival will be canceled for, you know, they had originally scheduled it in late August. But, you know, this kind of was affected by the COVID-19 pandemic because, you know, at the beginning of January, we're just beginning to start vaccinating people. And the president of the Superior Rotary Club, which helps organize the Lake Superior Dragon Boat Festival, basically said that they begin recruiting in January. But since it's only been recent that everyone has started reconnecting and returning to normal activities, they didn't think that there was enough time to do all of that this year to make the festival a success. And so they're setting their sights on next year's festival.
All right. Well, it'll be worth waiting for. We've been speaking with Danielle Kading, the Superior Base reporter for WBR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
And Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks so much, Robin.
You can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport. And be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with more of the music of Brianne Marie and the Front Porch Sinners. Stay safe, everyone.
Watch the sun rise.